The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
In my opinion, when people ask what the victory is for you, for Ukraine, I usually agree with borders, coming back to the borders of the 1991. However, for me personally, victory is when Ukrainian families unite in Ukraine, not abroad.
Hello, Stephanomics here, the podcast that brings you the global economy. Ukraine needs its women to come home, and soon. Almost a year and a half after President Putin's invasion, the human cost for Russia's neighbour has been devastating. And Ukraine's economy has also shrunk by at least a third, in part because a large chunk of its female workforce is no longer there. Policymakers in Kiev are acutely aware that the longer those displaced families stay away, the more they will put down roots in their host countries, and the less likely it is that these vital workers will come home. In a minute, I'll talk to migration expert Marta Foresti about the challenge facing Ukraine and the practical steps it could take to encourage its women to return. But first, here's our Ukraine bureau chief in Kyiv, Dasha Krasnoludska.
Oh, here it is. There you are. That's an air raid. An air raid siren. Several of them going off here in the center of the Ukrainian capital.
Now, when Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine a year and a half ago, it's easy now to forget the shock and chaos that followed.
Good morning from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. Gunfire and explosions have been heard here and in the second city of Kharkiv.
Within days, they had reached the outskirts of Kiev. There were gunfights in the city center. Millions of civilians, mostly women with children, fled to safety abroad in a spectacle that was at the same time horrific and inspiring. Countries from Poland to Canada flung open their doors to take them in.
Since Russian tanks rolled across Ukrainian borders, triggering a war that killed thousands of civilians, forced millions to flee.
It was mostly women trying desperately to get their kids onto trains, because men aged 18 to 60 were banned from leaving the country. While many have returned already, there are still 6.3 million Ukrainian refugees abroad, with no end to the war in sight. And that's a growing concern for Kyiv. Because what if Ukraine's women don't come back?
The majority of Ukrainian of people who left Ukraine, I would not rather call them refugees. I would call the people who temporarily left the country are women, and these are women with high educational degrees. 60% of women are with high educational degrees, and although they usually have children, that's why they left.
That's Tatiana Berezhna, Ukraine's deputy minister for the economy. Berezhna is in charge of labor policies and is worried that the longer the women stay away, getting jobs, learning the local language, seeing their kids make new friends in new schools, the less likely it is they'll return.
In my opinion, when people ask what the victory is for you, for Ukraine, I usually agree with borders coming back to the borders of the 1991. However, for me personally, victory is when Ukrainian families unite in Ukraine, not abroad.
That matters for a lot of different reasons. But a big one is that the government has ambitious plans for Ukraine's recovery after the war. It aims to double the size of the country's badly damaged economy by 2032. That's going to take huge quantities of investment. The World Bank says $411 billion over a decade, and it's going to take a lot of people. The government says it needs to find 4.5 million more workers in order to succeed, and getting all working-age women back from abroad would cover about half that deficit. Alex Isakov at Bloomberg Economics ran some calculations to estimate what the cost would be to the economy if none of the working-age women among the refugees should return. The answer? $20 billion a year, or 10% of the economy, even before the war shrank it by almost a third. So, will they come back?
All decision about buying made the limits. So.
This is Oleg Horohovsky, co-founder of Monobank, a mobile-only bank service provider. If you didn't catch him, he said, all decisions about buying are made by women, in his own opinion, of course.
Yeah.
Without women and kids, economy will not grow, I'm sure.
His business has still grown since the start of the war, in part because it's easy for people to set up an account and bank on his app when they're on the move. But he has no illusions about that continuing if the overall economy cannot grow too.
But it could be a super hard project because war can continue quite a long time. Now, continuous long time, more than 1 year.
Yeah.
People assimilate in a new places. The kids start going to school. Their mothers start working and find some jobs. So Ukraine has to do, has to motivate Ukrainians to return.
In many ways, Ukraine will have to start from scratch. Entire cities have been decimated. In some, basic infrastructure that had already been neglected for the 30 years since the Soviet collapse was damaged further. Even without the constant threat from Russian missiles, this would be a very difficult task. Here is Mykola Kapacina, who owns Rosted Terminal Concord LLC, a shipping services company in Mykolaiv. It's a port city in the south that was on the front lines for much of the war, getting shelled on a near daily basis.
The other side of the medal is that there is no jobs still for those Mykolaiv citizens who want to come back. The logistics, it is still in the worst condition. The port is blocked, and all these facilities are now blocked, completely blocked. So to make Mykolaiv absolutely attractive, the critical point is to restart the port activity.
And for women, especially those with children, there are even simpler questions.
Well, I would need to be sure that the situation in Ukraine is safe for my son in the first place.
That is Valeria Lulko, a 42-year-old businesswoman who used to run a company in Kyiv that helped multinationals like Paramount Pictures to sell licenses in Ukraine. Now she has a job marketing consumer products in Frankfurt, and her 12-year-old son goes to school there too. Valeria is well-educated and speaks multiple languages, as does her son, which has made their transition a bit easier. But others are far more limited.
There are a lot of people who fleeded without like knowledge of any language except of Ukrainian and Russian. And for them, it's way, way more complicated to like get themselves to integrate in the society and so on. So most of those people are planning to get back to Ukraine just because they don't find themselves here.
That won't be enough. To attract those 4.5 million workers, Ukraine is developing several programs such as loans for soldier spouses to start their own businesses. It's also trying to reform labor laws to close the gender pay gap. In Mykolaiv and other cities, schools and bus stops are getting bomb shelters.
Because we know that even if the victory comes, this Russia will be at our borderline, at our borders forever. That's why we need to be prepared to any other attacks. So the safety efforts and the safety measures will be better than before the full-scale invasion.
In Kyiv, I'm Darina Krasnoluska for Bloomberg News.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
So let me catch up briefly with Alex Isakov, who's our Russia and Central Eastern Europe economist, currently based in Dubai, who I had asked to take a look at this question of the missing women, refugees who've left Ukraine and what kind of hole that represents in Ukraine's future. And he very kindly came up with some numbers, a couple of which were included in that piece, but I wanted to get into it a little bit more. Alex, thank you very much for joining us. It's a very striking estimate that you have that if none of the around 3 million working age women who have are estimated to have left Ukraine since Russia's invasion, if none of them ever return, it would cost the economy $20 billion a year, or about 10% of the pre-war GDP. I know that's a worst case, but how did you get to that number?
We've basically done our analysis in two steps. First, we've looked at the employment rates among the prime age females in Ukraine and tried to understand which kind of proportion of these nearly 3 million females will be employed or working. And then we've looked at the pre-war data on the distribution of essentially added value produced by various industries in which those females have been employed before Russia's invasion. So what we do is we essentially account for both the volume of labor Ukraine lost and the productivity, like the distribution between industries of that labor. And in additionally, as a third step, in this cost, we include the labor lost due to the families reunited abroad. Ukraine's deputy economy minister, Tatiana Berezhnaya, she said like the victory for Ukraine would be when Ukrainian families could be reunited within country, not outside the country. So even in economic terms, families uniting outside the country will be costly for the country and will contribute to this loss of around $20 billion of added value each year.
And we see that impact, I guess, already in what's happened to Ukraine's economy in the last year, because the sectors, well, you were looking at this, that the sectors where women were most likely to be employed are also some of the sectors that have been most hard hit. Is that right?
Yes, correct. So Ukrainian economy has lost a third of its GDP last year, to be precise, 29%. And we see that the largest damage has been incurred with by the sectors that have like this largest gender imbalance. So if you look at hospitality and trade, this has the like largest share of female employment and has been hardest hit. And on the other hand of the spectrum, the mobilization and other kind of things that are related to war has hit the predominantly male employment industry, such as construction and transport.
And I guess it's striking. I mean, was the labor force participation in Ukraine higher than other countries of the women's labor force participation?
That's true. So this is, I think, a deeper point, which has like probably some upside to it. The labor participation rate in Ukraine for women is not that high. It's actually lower than for most of the developed countries. But on the other hand, the share of women in the labor force in employment is 48%. And it's actually pretty high. So it's higher than in Germany, in the United States, in most of the European countries. And this is mostly due to demography. So this is not like a high participation rate, but it's actually related to the fact that women live longer, participate in the workforce longer than men, and there are more of them. So like this is the question mostly of demography, not of high participation rates. The upside here is that, and we see that actually in a lot of post-war reverse migration studies, is that when refugees, former refugees go back to the country, they actually bring a lot of social values and approaches to work, etc., etc., from their host countries. And we could expect that labor participation for women post-war will be higher.
That's interesting. So there's not, it's not that they're more likely to participate, it's just that there are more women, but potentially we might see they might even be more valuable if we can get them back, or if Ukraine can get them back, they might be even more valuable to the economy than they were before. I guess final question, Alex, you spend most of your time looking at the Russian economy. We've mentioned that the Ukraine economy has shrunk by a third since Russia's invasion. What's happened to the Russian economy?
Russia lost a little bit more than 2% last year. It's on track to grow around 1%. Like it's mostly government spending. It's mostly driven by a large expansion of public spending related to war and related to various subsidies. So it's probably not that sustainable, and the growth rates in the future will be much lower than they were in the past. But Russian economy seems to be like faring better than consensus expected.
As you say, potentially not sustainable, but a pretty stark contrast with what's happened in Ukraine. Alex Isikoff, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Stephanie.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
So we can round out this special program on the missing women and children of Ukraine now by talking to Marta Foresti, a senior fellow from the UK development think tank ODI, who was previously its Europe director and senior migration expert. Marta, We've identified in this programme a very large hole in Ukraine's reconstruction plans, which Ukrainians are well aware of, but I'm not sure it's a big part of conversations outside the country. How important are those absent women to Ukraine's future?
Thank you, Stephanie. And this is fascinating because, of course, is a very particular feature of the terrible conflict in Ukraine and Russia's invasion that has meant that so many women have fled. And now Ukraine is in this position and it needs, you know, to really find ways to attract them back. But we forget that this is a challenge that many countries have in trying to get people who leave, who are often the most talented, the most, you know, those with resources, those with degrees and those with ambitions to come back to either reconstruct or contribute to economies. And so it's useful to think about Ukraine, given this specific aspect of the story that relates specifically to women, also to challenge the perception that often is just men who flee, and also that there is no value to those who flee a country in search of protection and better future. So there are lots of lessons here, and lessons that other countries, including in European neighbors, are all struggling actually to attract back to their economies, both their own, you know, people who have left, but also to attract new migrants from neighboring countries to contribute to the future. And it's interesting that there is this debate in Ukraine already about whether, you know, for the reconstruction, it would be important to attract the women back, but also reach out to try to attract other young migrants from neighboring countries.
And I mean, it is somewhat of a special case that, you know, the bulk of the people who've left the country have been women. And that's obviously there's a very practical reason for that, but men are not allowed to leave given the security situation and the need to be defending the country. But if just as a migration specialist, what special challenges does that represent when you're thinking about a predominantly female migrant population that's dispersed, as we've heard, you know, we hear in the programme about, they're in Brazil, they're in Germany, they're in Poland, they're in the UK, they are now everywhere.
So the first thing to say, which is an important reminder, is that if you look at global migration figures, people tend to forget that women migrate as much as men globally, of course. There are very specific differences. We just mentioned Ukraine with a very particular story. There is obviously more men and younger men to leave Africa towards Europe. But generally speaking, it's important to recognize that these days women migrate as much as men. When it comes to Ukraine, of course, women are key players in modern economies, and so many countries around Europe. Think about how many southern European countries really struggle precisely because they have low participation of women in labour markets. So it's not surprising that attracting women back is such a priority. And in terms of the challenges that this particular experience, of course, you know, a lot of these women fled with children, and so the countries hosting in the first place had to step up efforts with things like places in schools and housing. But it's interesting to see also in your article how many women have actually found opportunities to contribute to local economies. We know that people who leave, whether they leave by choice or they're forced to do so because of conflict, we know that people who leave tend to be the most resourceful, those who have talent, energy, often financial resources to do so. So it's not surprising that they find opportunities where they go. But of course, with time, these women are now making a life and contributing to societies and economies elsewhere. And so like other countries, my own country where I'm now, Italy, interestingly enough, has a similar challenge that, you know, there are too many young, talented people leaving the country and the country needs to attract them back to contribute to the future. And this goes hand in hand with demographic trends, which are common all over Europe.
If we think of the sort of broader experience of displaced populations and the challenge that potentially war-torn countries face in trying to attract these people back, people that, as you've identified, are often the most economically important and skilled members of a country. In the case of the Bosnian War, there's still a large chunk of the people who left have not returned. But elsewhere in the world, are there lessons for Ukraine?
So there are lots of lessons to learn, and it's fascinating how bad we are at learning lessons when it comes to people who move, because tragically it interacts with, you know, such, you know, toxic and heightened sort of political debate. It sometimes is really hard to see the wood for the tree in terms of what's going on. I mean, I think it's both things are true, that, you know, some people are reluctant to go back, partly because they do find a life in host countries and communities. But it's equally true that so many people have a longing to come back to where they're from, and particularly people who were forced to flee because of conflict. Really, you know, there is a real determination and willingness to go back and find other ways to contribute to reconstruction, to wherever people are from. I have first-hand experience of Sierra Leone, which is a country that was until recently affected by a terrible violent conflict. And I mean, I've been working closely with the mayor of Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, who herself spent many of the war years in the UK, where she became an accomplished accountant and got a degree from UK universities, and now, you know, is back as a mayor of the capital city and determined to make a contribution. And I've been working with artists and creatives, designers based in Freetown, and I was really struck how many of them were so-called returnees, so people who chose to go back after the conflict. We all know how much remittances matter for local economic development, and of course people bring back those resources when they return. But importantly, and often overlooked, is the know-how, is the knowledge, is the network, is the, you know, the inspiration that people find away from home, and they bring it back. And so I was struck by how many of the local creatives that are, you know, really determined to support the reconstruction of Sierra Leone through the creative sectors and the creative economy, that so much can do to also portray a different story about the value and the beauty of what gets made in Sierra Leone, and to attract to people to the beautiful country that Sierra Leone is. How many of them are returnees, how many of them are women, and how many of them are making the most of the connections they built in the US, in the UK and elsewhere, to make that happen. It doesn't come without challenges. You know, there are also tensions between returnees and those who did not have a chance to leave. Once again, people who leave tend to be the better off. And so it's not, you know, inclusion doesn't come automatically. But I was really inspired by the potential and the determination and the economic contribution and the know-how.
I wonder whether there are specific policies that, I mean, Ukraine's thinking about how they approach online schooling, for example, which many of the displaced Ukrainian children are doing, but they want to not have it, perhaps not offer it anymore from September, as a way of encouraging people to return. But of course, it could have the opposite effect of loosening the ties that had to continue to exist between the children and their home country. Just from your experience, are there any particular policies that would be more supportive of women thinking of coming back?
Well, let me mention two of them. One you would expect, which is what, again, a number of European countries are all experimenting with, which, of course, are fiscal policies. And so making it easier and create fiscal incentives, particularly for people who are likely to bring back also some financial resources to facilitate that investment and to make it attractive taxation-wise. And so that's something that happens in a number of European countries that can be sort of studied and applied and adapted to other countries. The other one, which might sound a little bit counterintuitive, but is something I'm increasingly interested in, is that it's really important to make sure that, you know, to make sure that those who come back can also leave again. I've been looking, for example, recently at visa policies. If somebody has a life and has connections in another country, and if returning means that you're never going to be allowed to leave again, you're really going to think twice before you do so. So to really create mechanisms and visas that can facilitate the movement of people between, you know, the countries of origin, but also the countries where they're likely to have built at least part of their life, will be really, really important. Again, going back to my example of Sierra Leone, it is extraordinarily difficult for a Sierra Leone national to obtain, say, a business or a visitor's visas to Europe. We've done some analysis on that, and it's quite shocking, and it's the same in a number of African countries. Now, it may well be that some of those returnees would have acquired a passport in the process, and they may come back with, you know, as with dual nationality. But that's not true for everyone. Not every country allows you to do so. And so thinking at visa regimes that really facilitate your ongoing movement may well be one incentive to facilitate returns, as well as obviously programs to ensure that can be successful reintegration, particularly when there are, you know, say, drivers of the conflict that mean that people that return might find themselves in difficult circumstances, both financially, but also in relation, for example, to ethnic tensions and other challenges. But these are some of the practical things that could be thought of, which, again, in migration debates are very, very rarely considered, given that all efforts are still in trying to keep people away and not to encourage people to go back.
Oh, and that's a fascinating thought. I think that should definitely get. I hope it's already on someone's list in Brussels or in the capitals, because, as you say, it's counterintuitive. Continuing from that, we clearly have made something of an exception in our kind of political conversation in Europe for Ukraine. The Ukrainian migrants are being considered just very differently to migrants from other countries. Do you get a sense, Marta, that this conflict and these migrants have started to humanize the face of migrant change, the attitude to refugees more generally? Are you hopeful on that?
Not really. Sadly, not. I wish I could say. I wish I could say I was. But it is precisely because this exceptionalism of this crisis, but many other crises, you know, this tendency to just deal with each of them as one-offs, as something where somebody makes a superhuman effort rather than really focus on the reality of people's movements across borders, you know, looking for opportunities and jobs, to really try to find a narrative around the movement of people that challenges some of the, you know, the scaremongery and the fears. And unfortunately, a crisis of any kind does not resolve that. And in fact, my slight worry is that we go from crisis to crisis, and at every crisis we make it worse. The next one coming up is the climate crisis, where we're all going to be terrified of people being displaced as a result of the climate emergency. And again, that doesn't make it easier to think of policies and political narratives that take away the anxieties and the fears and work with the practicalities of, you know, allowing people to work. Like, that's a very concrete example. Has the Ukraine crisis changed the dial and made any progress on liberalizing policies to make it so that in different European countries, those who are seeking asylum can work? The answer is no, largely. We have created pockets of, you know, humanitarian response. We've seen, you know, people opening their houses to refugees, which is great. But that's not what's needed. What is needed is a form of pragmatic, rational, and realistic, you know, suite of policies, not just about migration and migration control, but critically labour market, skills shortages, demographic trends, where people come into a country being attractive to other people is actually a good thing politically. And we're very far away from having made a case for it.
Marta Foresti, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Well, that's it for this entire series of Stephanomics, but you can spend the rest of your summer with Bloomberg's economic insights and news on the Bloomberg Terminal website or app. This episode was produced by Magnus Henriksen, Yang Yang and Summer Sadi. The reporters on the Ukraine story were Mark Champion, Andrew Langley and Alexandra Kudrytsky. It was narrated by our Ukraine bureau chief in Kyiv, Dasha Krasnoludska. Special thanks to Alex Isakov and Marta Foresti. Molly Smith is the executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Sage Bowman.
The The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.